This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're doing Love Actually. I've talked about it. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one, and we will see you next time.
Oh, gentle listeners, are you
ready for one dry kiss? One dry kiss, yeah.
Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy, irreverent love letter to rom-coms, where in the month of August, we're doing Christmas in August.
Why'd you say August like that? You're all August.
It's not your typical summery Christmas month, but we're making it ours.
Is there ever a typical summery Christmas month?
July.
Following the masses. Just following the masses is what everybody's doing. There is no typical Christmas month other than December. People deviate from the timeline, and so do we. We're just doing a little bit different and with a little more flair. That's all.
I am here with my resolute, Christmassy in August, flairific co-host, Miss Tamara Cosio.
I thought you were going to call me a ho-ho host. That's what I'm going to call you. And I am here with the ho-ho host with the most, Corinne Edding.
I'll take it. Oh, my goodness.
And to be clear, I'm not calling you a ho. It was like, you know, a nod to Santa Claus.
Ho-ho-ho. I'll be a
Speaking
ho.
Of hoes, how's your love life?
I will plead the fifth on that one. I'm just so excited to dive into Love Actually.
Oh my God.
When I first saw this movie, which was not that long ago, it was just a few years ago, so I did not see it in my teens.
Shut up!
Or 20s or whatever.
Really?
Yeah, really. I'd never seen it. Everybody'd seen it. I'd never seen it. And I was like, oh, this is going to be an epic love story. And I was like, what the fuck is going on with this biznatch? I thought I was going to get swept away. And instead, I was swept away on a pile of what the fuck? And because I did not have, like, younger nostalgia feelings around a lot of the romance plot lines. But I have to say, while I was scripting this bad boy out, I actually appreciated it more the second time around. So there you go.
That's good. You really need to see this movie in your formative 20s, early 20s, in the early aughts. Truly appreciate it. Same thing. I saw it very soon after it was released in 2003. I was like, oh my God, epic. Best Christmas movie ever. And then throughout the years, I'm like, oh, it's a good Christmas movie to. So the progression, in my opinion of it, has definitely changed over the years. But still, I still love it. It still has a warm, gooey spot in my heart. Yes, there are some problematic storylines. But I mean, shit. Everything seems to have problematic storylines these days that was made back in the 90s, early 2000s. Yes. And you know what? I just got to love it for what it is.
Well, once I embraced it more as an exploration of different kinds of love versus what I thought it was going to be, which was this great, like, romance of all these different people just falling in love. This is going to be amazing. I appreciated it a lot more, so...
But it is people falling in love all over the place and so amazing, just in some really weird ways.
Sure.
Well, okay, well, I guess we will get into it because
I'm like, into it.
We will so get into it. We are so going to get into it. It's just, again, it's like up there with Twilight and the problematic. I love it. I know it's ridiculous and I don't care. Takes a big woman to say that. Big woman.
Oh, Twilight.
I can't help it. I love the things I love.
Hey.
The heart wants what the heart wants.
Look, I've just been spending time thinking about the movie DOA and how much I really enjoyed watching that back in the day. So I understand. The heart wants what the heart wants.
What is DOA?
Dead on Arrival. It's based on the video. I think it's based on the video game. It's got Jamie Presley in it. It's a fighting movie.
Uh-huh.
And it's got this epic opening scene, one of which where this woman is being attacked, but she's really just like being given an invitation to her fighting thing or whatever, and she like literally fights her way into like throwing on a bra midair. It's so good. So good.
I saw you look up at your wall. Is it in your library? Is it in your video library? Your DVD library?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Only the best movies get in there. DOA is one of them.
How come we haven't watched this together? I mean, it's right there next to your TV. I've been over many times. You've not shared the gem with me.
Oh, I need to get a Blu-ray player again.
Oh, that'll do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'm just going to pop it somewhere in a crevice by your TV and expect you to act out the whole movie for me.
Look, here's what I'm going to do. When I come down and visit you and Larry, or maybe when you and Larry come up to visit me, we can all watch it together because it'll be an action movie. Eric Roberts is in it as the villain. I mean, you can't get better than Eric Roberts as the villain.
I don't know. We watched Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, so good.
And I was like, I watched it with him. And he was like, what in the actual fuck are we watching?
Like the most beautiful love story of all time.
I don't think he got to the beautiful love story portion. He was just like, I don't understand what is going on. And then he fell asleep. So.
Oh, well, you need to watch it like from beginning to end to really like get the full arc. And you really need to pay attention, which is why I was glad I saw it in the movie theater. Because like that's the best place to pay attention.
Yes. Agreed. Although I did take him to go see Indiana Jones and he fell asleep there as well.
Oh, no.
Anywho, Corinne.
Yes.
I shudder to ask this question, but do you by chance possibly have a synopsis for Love Actually?
Why, yes, I do. And I would like to say that I was inspired by you with this synopsis. Because you gave me some feedback because I was like, I'm not sure how I'm going to do this. There's so many characters. I did this outline and it took a lot out of me. I don't even know where to go from here. And you said, don't mention anybody. Just keep it simple. I'm paraphrasing.
Yes.
But Tamara's nodding. Yes. So,
yes.
Synopsis. Love Actually. A lot of things happen to a lot of people around love during the Christmas season. Also, should be named Love, comma, Actually? Question mark.
Oh, that's perfect. That was beautiful. Beautifully written.
And now, Tamara, are you ready to start us on this journey that is such a journey? It's going to be in two parts.
Yes, maybe we should have said that at the top of the show, that Love Actually, part one.
Part one.
We've only done this one time before, and that was because...
That was on accident.
We did. That was unintentional. Oh my gosh, what was the name of that movie?
Mix Up in the Mediterranean.
Oh my fucking God, yes.
Yeah. But this is very intentionally split into two parts.
That was accidental and early on, and now we looked at this beast and we're like, oh no, bitch, we need two sections. We totally need two sections. The amount of stuff we're going to be discussing, maybe three. I'm just kidding, only two. All right. Yes, I am totally ready to dive into the first part of Love Actually. And it starts. We're at the Rivals Gate at Heathrow Airport, seeing all kinds of people joyfully embracing. David, the newly elected prime minister, narrates, musing, "When I start feeling down about the state of the world, I think of the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport. Old, young, family, friends, all happily greeting people. If you think about it, during our final moments, we more commonly don't want to connect with those we hate, but those we love. And if you think about it, love is really the stronger, overriding expression. And if you look for it, I've got a sneaky feeling that love actually is all around." Aww. The last words appear on the screen as he speaks them. "Love actually is all around," which fades to read just "Love Actually," the name of our motherfucking movie.
Aww.
And even back in 2003 when this was made, I was like, that is a good gosh darn point, David. Thank you. Because is there really a person out there that's petty or pissed enough to be experiencing their final moments and instead of calling somebody they love, call somebody they hate and tell them, I'm going to die, but I didn't want to do it before saying, I fucking loathe you.
I think there are a few people who would do that, but minimal, very minimal.
Probably. I would not ever be one of those people because, of course, I want everybody to know that I love them if that was the last thing I could say to them. Not Corinne, you remember that CD you borrowed from me back in 1993? If I live this through this and survive this, bitch, you better give it back to me, okay? So Eternal Flame is our song, not your song.
I'm just impressed that you had a CD back in 1993.
Didn't they have CDs back in 1993?
They did. They were just very expensive.
Oh, well, I definitely didn't have one then. I was just using it to prove a point.
Don't worry, Tam. I made a mixtape and Eternal Flame is on it just for you.
Oh.
Close your eyes. Give me your hand. Do you feel the Christmas tree beating? Do you understand?
Okay, Billy Mac.
Do you see the twinkle lights? I'm just, you know, I'm getting into the whole Billy Mac of it all. Yeah.
Do you see the sleigh? Because it's Santa. It all his reindeer crossing over the sky. Say his name.
Santa.
Sunshine through the rain.
Snowflakes through the rain. Wait. Anywho.
It's all over the place.
It's all over the place.
Totally worth it.
Totally worth it. Just like Billy Mack, the aging pop star extraordinaire who probably toured with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young back in the day, is singing a cover of the Troggs' Love Is All Around. We were inspired by Billy Mack, thank you. But he's not getting it right because, as his manager Joe reminds him, we're doing a different version because everyone knows the original. Bill starts again. I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Love is all a... Oh, fuck, bugger, wink, shitty ass, head and hole. He rubs his eyes, takes a breath, and you can tell. This time, he's got it. Bill starts singing again. I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Christmas is all around me, and so the feeling grows. He continues singing while his manager Bill dances happily in the background. So if you really love Christmas, come on and let it snow. He stops singing and speaks into the mic. This is shit, isn't it? Bill happily responds, yup, solid gold shit, maestro. And Bill gets a half smile on his face. And we're left wondering, is Bill on board with the sword? Not.
Cheap cash grab, cash grab, cash grab.
Gotta get it while getting's good.
Mm-hmm. The words flash across the screen. 5 weeks till Christmas. And Karen, played by Emma Thompson, is at home scurrying around the kitchen when she gets a call from Daniel, played by Liam Neeson. He says, sorry to bother you, but I didn't know who else to call. But Karen, ever the diplomat, says, I'm sorry, Daniel. I can't talk right now. There's something super important that I need to deal with. It's not that I'm not deeply sorry your wife just died, but can I call you back? Daniel, played by Liam Neeson. I already said that. Just so you know, Daniel's played by Liam Neeson. Daniel's played by Liam Neeson. Daniel's played by Liam Neeson.
Never forget. Never forget.
Hopefully somebody doesn't get kidnapped in this movie, but if they did, he'd be on it.
Yes.
He smirks good-naturedly and tells her to bugger off then. But when he hangs up, his sadness seems to weigh on him. Mm. Karen turns to her 8-year-old daughter and eagerly asks, okay, tell me your big news. Her daughter beams at her. We've been given our parts in the nativity play, and I'm first lobster. Karen. Karen excitedly responds, "Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize there was more than one lobster at the birth of Jesus." The daughter gives her a condescending look, fitting for an 8-year-old, and says, "Duh. And I have a feeling we're in for one hell of a disjointed fever dream of a play." So, theories for all out there that haven't seen this. How could a lobster wind up at Bethlehem? Current thoughts?
Well, you know, I say the dear sweet baby Jesus is very, very powerful. And you know what one wants after a long journey, after, you know, working really hard to get
out of that birth canal?
Get out of that birth canal. Fucking lobster. Hell yeah. I mean, lobster bake. Nothing brings the community together quite like a lobster bake. What better way to introduce sweet baby Jesus to the world?
So the wise men, theoretically speaking, could have brought frankincense, myrrh, surf, and turf for the baby Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yes, that is all very much the case. And if it was more of an adult-themed play, I could see somebody maybe getting crabs at Christmas, but not lobster.
But we don't want those kinds of crabs for Christmas or any other time of year.
I'm just saying, it just threw me off. It just threw me off. I was just like, crabs, if it was more adult themed, lobster, ha. Huh. But I guess we'll figure it out when we see the play.
Yes. But will we?
I'm going to hope. I'm going to have faith.
Oh, like in Sweet Baby Jesus. That's good. Well, you know, here's the thing. If I were a parent and my child said, "I got my role in the nativity, I'm playing first lobster," I'd be like, "Oh, fuck yeah, this is going to be a shit show and I am here for it. How much glitter should I put on this lobster costume that I'm making?"
I could just picture like all those Renaissance paintings of like baby Jesus where he's got like a cross in one hand and he's doing like the peace or whatever sign.
Oh, yeah. The little. Yeah.
Yes. In this nativity scene, he's going to be like holding little peace sign and a lobster in the other.
Yes.
Oh, it's the holy lobster.
Exactly. We're going to be joining the Church of the Lobster after this recording. Thank you.
Yes.
My next section I have entitled, "Colin is Gross and Simulated Sex is Romantic."
Yeah.
In a London office, Colin, the sandwich guy, excitedly buzzes around the office with his basket of food, sexually harassing the women. Nothing whets an appetite quite like that.
Mm-mm.
He hands a bag of nuts to a woman saying, "Try my lovely nuts." And he hands a muffin to another woman saying, "Beautiful muffin for a beautiful lady." He then stops next to Mia's desk and says, "Morning, my future wife." She looks at him beleaguered and walks into an office. And I'm wondering how he is not barred from that office. And perhaps the entire town of London. I am asking for a friend. Do you have an explanation, Tam?
I would love to see their list of people that get banned from the whole city of London. They're just like, "Nope, nope, you, out.
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 Out."
Ushered to the city limits, pushed off to the side and being like, "And don't come back.
No lobster for you.
With your nuts or your muffins. Goodbye, sir. I said goodbye.
I said goodbye." Yes. I never thought I would say that simulated sex was romantic. However, I would say one of the most romantic plot lines in this movie is the two body double actor people who are simulating sex on a movie set.
Yes.
They nervously introduce themselves to each other, John and Judy, as that's what one does after pretending to penetrate someone from behind.
So is this actually like something people do for money? They are stand-ins for the lighting crew?
Yes, which is why I was like, originally I had titled them like porn body doubles, but we're not spending money like that on porn. So it had to have been some kind of super sexy regular movie that, yeah.
Oh, okay, because that makes sense.
Yeah. Although, like, the whole super nakedity of it all, I was like, I think that's a little creative, whatever. But, yes, that is something. They have body doubles come in to stand in so that they can get lighting right on and shots right on certain scenes. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Alrighty then. And, most likely across town, Jamie, played by Colin Firth, leaves his apartment in a hurry to get to his friends Juliet and Peter's wedding, but not before effusing at his girlfriend about how beautiful she is and how much he loves her, even when she's feeling miserable. Sadly, she isn't going with them because she's sick.
Aww. I hope she feels better soon.
No, and I don't. But he makes it to the wedding where, at the wedding, Mark, Corinne did this outline, and she pretty much gave everybody a name. Like, this was played by Keira Knightley. This was played by Colin Firth. Mark, she did not give a name to. She's like, Mark needs not to be known, but I put it in there because Mark is played by Andrew Lincoln, and I only know him because I most recently started watching The Walking Dead, which I've never seen before, and he is Rick from The Walking Dead. Weird Mark here, Rick from The Walking Dead.
Oh, I gave him a name.
In my life.
Hashtag gross bestie. That was the name I gave him.
Okay, well, that's fine too, but I was just saying, like, the actor's name is Andrew Lincoln.
I didn't recognize gross bestie. I didn't really recognize it. I mean, I slightly recognized him, but he wasn't, like, of the recognizable level that of the other people, so I didn't say anything. Yeah.
Understandably so, and with me neither. Like, I was just like, Oh, that's that guy that, you know, blah 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 blah. But I'm 7 seasons deep in Walking Dead, and so I watch it like religiously, and Rick is the leader of his like group of people, and like in every single episode. So,
and is he a gross bestie in that, or is he like, what kind of character does he play?
He does his best gross bestie work here, definitely.
Aww.
He is a zombie slaying, post-apocalyptic, like, leading his crew out of danger, ex-sheriff type in The Walking Dead.
Okay, that sounds kind of hot. That does not sound like gross bestie.
Mark, played by Andrew Lincoln, is the best man and stands next to the groom, Peter. You're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of this name, Corinne.
I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Chiwetel Ejiofor, in the church. It's Peter's wedding day, and he hisses to Mark, "No surprises." Mark looks positively clammy and responds, "No surprises." Peter doesn't believe his friend and retorts, "Unlike the stag night with the Brazilian sex workers?" I would like to circle back to that later. Or Tamara says, "I would like to circle back to that later." Mark shakes his head. "I can admit that was not the right move." They give each other a bro hug in part so Mark can grab his video camera and Peter can look down the aisle at his lovely bride, Juliet, played by Keira Knightley.
I'm sure I'm cutting this part out where you burped, but you suddenly like clasped your hand over your heart, and I think that was for the burp, but I was like, oh, she's really taken with Juliet. Wow.
Keira Knightley just looks so stunning in her wedding dress. No, I had to burp. Anyways, the ceremony happens. We don't see it. The duo gets married, and Peter again utters, this time surprised, that there were no surprises. He playfully ribs his friend before he and Juliet happily walk down the aisle. When suddenly they hear from the choir, love, love, love. And a small choir starts singing the Beatles' All You Need Is Love. Then, from out of the rafters, the British pop star Lyndon David Hall comes out and starts singing the solo. There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Dun, dun, dun. And when it gets to the interlude, a flute section from the back of the bride's side chimes in. And on the next bridge, a brass section from the groom's side. And they all play along while Juliet looks around delighted. She asks Peter, "Did you do this?" But he shakes his head and points over at Mark, who throws up his hands and shakes his head in denial. But Peter knows it was him and smiles because it was a much, much better surprise than the sex workers at the bachelor party.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
Peter doesn't seem like the type who's like, gotta get one last in before I get hooked up to my ball and chain. And now we see Mr. Darcy. I mean, Jamie. Run back to his flat to see if his girlfriend is feeling any better and would like to go to the reception. When he enters his flat, he sees his brother. "Huh. Oh, hey, what are you doing here?" he asks. His brother stands awkwardly in the room. I just came to borrow some CDs. Jamie feels that things are off, but tries moving forward like everything is normal. "Well, I came back to see if my girlfriend's feeling any better. He pauses and then says, listen, what do you think about taking Mom out for her birthday this Friday? I feel like we haven't been as attentive to her lately as we should be. Suddenly, their conversation is interrupted by Jamie's girlfriend's voice calling out from the other room. Hurry up, big boy. I'm naked and want you at least twice before Jamie gets home. Nothing is ambivalent about that situation. Once she speaks up, it is very clear that Jamie's brother is getting to ride the pony with Jamie's girlfriend. Yeah.
And I don't want to be superficial, but Jamie is played by Colin Firth, and his brother is just some nondescript, like, nothing special type. And I know that looks aren't everything, but I'm just like, honey.
Oh. But Colin Firth is like, he plays the nondescript guises, you know.
No.
He's like, kind of teddy bear kind of guys.
Well, yes, I guess so, because he completely wins my heart in this one, too, with all of his love interests that we shall go into later. Don't want to jump the gun. Too many things going, too many moving parts, too many things happening. Can't jump over sections. And Corinne, since she wrote this lovely outline, wrote this nice little note to me. Tamara, you get to deal with Colin the pervy sandwich guy this time, but you get Laura Linney asking if Mark is gay as a consolation. Which is chef's kiss perfection.
One of my favorite moments in the movie.
Yes. Hashtag Colin Pervy Sandwich Guy is at Julie and Peter's wedding reception. And we have the pleasure, quotation marks, of seeing Colin, the predatory sandwich guy, at work. He's passing hors d'oeuvres and doing a terrible job of it, approaching women and asking if they want food. No, they don't. And whizzing by the two people who tried grabbing some of his food, but they aren't attractive women, so he pays them no mind and hurries off. He finally approaches a woman, offering her some of his hors d'oeuvres. She turns it down, and he agrees with her decision because, in his opinion, all the party food looks pretty terrible. In an effort to impress her, he puts an hors d'oeuvre in his mouth, chews a couple of times, and spits it out because it's so gross. She seems to get increasingly agitated at the schlep who's cornered her, but this last bit is the clincher because she's the caterer of the event and surprisingly doesn't appreciate his critique of her food.
Huh.
Defeated, Colin rushes back to the prep area with his friend. He's had an epiphany. You see, British women are stuck up. They don't appreciate someone with his sparkling personality and his hilarious sense of humor. What he needs to do is go to America, and he's going to get all the ladies because they're going to find him to be hilarious and love his British accent. Uh-huh. He exclaims, I'm going to be calling the sex god. And Corinne writes, and all I can say is that an accent can only get you so far, honey. And that's essentially what his friend says to him as well. I had a friend who had a British accent who got all the ladies, but he was also way more attractive than Mr. Colin. So,
way more attractive than Mr. Colin, and also not like
schmarmy.
Yes. Also not like, here's some nuts. Here's some of my nuts to try. You know, like,
yeah, put my nuts in your mouth.
Yeah.
I'm hilarious. Why don't you get me?
Yeah. No, no. He may have ultimately not been a good choice as a partner. However, as far as just like an initial encounter, totally great, hot, like good looking, good accent, good man. Now,
then he Colin talks and shuts all those doors. Or I thought you were talking about Colin.
Oh, I was going to say Colin, scrappy looking, okay accent, shouldn't open mouth.
Yes. Spews sexual harassment wherever he goes.
Yeah, yeah.
Really proficient at it.
You know what? In school, he got an A+ in sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not everyone who can say that.
I think he speaks sexual harassment at his first language.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. He is. I was going to say he's bilingual, but I don't know if he doesn't not speak sexual harassment.
Because he's definitely fluent. Definitely. Yes. Then it's still my turn. Sorry. Sorry, I was getting off on the sexual harassment tangent. And now we're back to hashtag gross bestie, a.k.a. Mark, a.k.a. Rick from The Walking Dead. However, the only other thing of note that happens at the wedding reception is while Mark is creepily, I mean, helpfully videotaping Peter and Juliet dancing, an American girl, Sarah, played by Laura Linney, approaches Mark and asks him if he's in love with Peter. Nice one, Sarah. Mark slams his video camera shut and insists he's not. But she was just checking in case he needed a sympathetic ear to pour his heart out to, because he was giving the couple a look.
Yes.
A look, if you know what I mean.
A very intense, focused, laser look.
Potentially scary if he didn't know them. Like, I would be fearful if they weren't well acquainted.
Yes.
I would be like, watch that guy over there that's hyper-focused on the couple and taping them incessantly.
I'm like, is this an episode of You Just Asking for a Friend?
Very well could be. It's another love tier and angle that Love Actually just doesn't explore further. We know what's happening, but they don't elaborate. But Sarah and Mark go on to commiserate on how bad the wedding DJ is. So bad! And how he could quite possibly be the worst DJ in history. They base their rating on the next song he plays and are livid and thoroughly correct on the worst title, because the DJ gets a little emotional as he announces, and the next song will be, and they call it Puppy Love.
Ooh. Ooh.
Because that is a staple at every wedding.
I was like,
no.
Commentary completely... completely true. Yeah.
Yes.
No, we...
Accurate.
Accurate, bad DJ. Bad, bad DJ.
Bad DJ, bad DJ.
Unless there's like a sock hop happening and we're like going completely retro, no.
If there was a sock hop, or we were in the 60s perhaps?
Yes.
Or at prom maybe, but a wedding?
Oh, no. And I thought that Tamara would appreciate my response to, they call it puppy love, where then I said, woof.
I'm sorry I didn't include that. Woof, indeed.
Oh, we move on to yet another person. Not enough new faces here. Not enough new faces.
Like, five? Is this five now? Like five storylines. We're five storylines in deep.
Oh my gosh. David, played by Hugh Grant, pulls up to the Prime Minister's house and does a double-handed wave to onlookers, which he immediately regrets. He is new to being Prime Minister, and 40-something-year-old David is feeling awkward. He goes inside and is greeted by Annie, who I'm guessing is his assistant. She brings him into a second room and introduces him to the household staff. First is Terrence, who's in charge. Terrence looks like he's about 70, and as he shakes David, the new Prime Minister's hand, I'm sure he's not expecting the sheer volume of, huh, that comes out of the PM's mouth. I had an uncle named Terrence. He was awful. We always suspected he was a pervert. But I very much like the looks of you. And I'm wondering how this guy got elected. Let me introduce myself to you for the first time, oh, household help. Oh, yeah, you look like a perv. Thanks. Great to meet ya.
He's saying he doesn't look like a perv. He's just named after one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You're right. You are so right. What was I thinking? That's so much better. So much better.
Very diplomatic, am
yes,
I right?
Yes, yes. David is then introduced to Pat, another 70-something-year-old who cleans the house. The PM bumbles, well, I should be easy. No kids running around, no pesky wife. His assistant swiftly moves him on to Natalie, who is a late 20-something-year-old in contrast to her two senior co-workers. Annie tells David, and Natalie is new, like you, and suddenly... And they call it puppy love. swells in the background. No, it does not.
No, it doesn't. It swells in their eyes, though.
Yes, yes. Heart eyes happen between the two of them, Natalie and David. And we find out that Natalie is similar to David. They shake hands, and Natalie obviously has a touch of whatever David has. She says, "Nice to meet you, David. I mean, sir. Shit, I can't believe I said that. And now I said shit twice. So sorry, sir." David chuckles. "Well, you didn't say fuck, so it all works out." Natalie smiles warmly at him. "Thank you, sir. I did have a premonition I was going to fuck up on the first..." Oh, shit. She covers her mouth and David chuckles. And he says, "Okay, well, I'll get my things and then we'll fix the country, shall we?" He follows Annie down the hall, but turns to have another look at the enchanting Natalie. Once David is alone in his office, he shakes his head. Bugger! He doesn't want to be some smarmy PM who has a fling with a member of his staff, but he recognizes the Zazazoo between him and Natalie. And it's strong. It's strong!
But not as strong as our feelings for Daniel, who Corinne labels this next section as the hottest widower there ever was. Hashtag Daniel. But, well, there's all kinds of love in Love Actually, like the newly married love, potential scandalous prime minister love, a love that definitely died when one brother found out his other brother was sexing up his partner. There's also the love that is cut short by death. And while Juliet and Peter are having their married love reception, Daniel, still played by Liam Neeson, is holding a service for his recently deceased wife, Joanna. Aww. He tells the people gathered that before she died, she created several requests for him. He's pretty sure that she wasn't serious about him bringing Claudia Schiffer to the service as his date. However, there were other things that she was very clear on, and one of those things was playing her eulogy slideshow to the Bay City Rollers, singing, "Bye bye, baby, baby, goodbye."
Aww.
As Joanna's life flashes before everyone in picture form, her young son Sam sadly sits in the front pew by himself. And we also see Karen, who previously promised to call Daniel back to talk to her daughter, which I'm sure she did call him back. I'm totally sure she did.
Super sure.
Sure. Absolutely. Or else she wouldn't have showed up. That would have just been rude.
Yes.
Daniel leaves the front of the room and grabs the corner of Joanna's coffin, along with others, ostensibly walking it out either to a hearse or a gravesite, or to burn it if it was like The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And, and Mark was there.
Where's Mark when you really need him? He's stalking Juliet.
Videotaping Peter and Juliet.
Yes. And now that we've had a wedding and a funeral, I think we're ready for some weekday regularity. And I'm not talking about fiber, which is how we end up back in the London office, where Curtis, the horrible sandwich guy, hit on many a working woman. Mia, who Curtis tried to claim as his future wife, goes into her boss man Harry's office. She lets him know Sarah is waiting for him. Harry mumbles, "Great, show her in." Oh, and Harry is played, he's Snape. He's Professor Snape.
That's what I was going to say. I'm like, I don't know his name, but he is Professor Snape.
Oh, Alan Rickman. Yes. Who is like super famous. Yeah. Alan Rickman. But so Harry is played by Alan Rickman. So he says, "Great, show her in." But Mia lingers in the doorway and Harry stops and looks over at her. How are you settling into the office? Learning what's good and what to avoid? Mia smiles. Yep. And then Sarah walks into his office, prompting Mia to make a hasty retreat. Harry greets Sarah. "Sarah, switch off your phone and tell me exactly how long you've been working here." Sarah gives a pretty exact approximation. I wouldn't be able to do that, but she is a woman with a memory. Apparently.
And mind you, this is Sarah, the American Laura Linney, that asked Mark if he was gay.
Because he was staring so intently.
Yes.
At Peter and Juliet. Yes.
Oh, how the stories intertwine. So this is American Sarah.
And she avoided being harassed by Curtis, the sandwich guy, at the wedding because she was talking on the phone, and he ended up just walking by her instead. Initially, yes. So, Sarah does not switch off her phone, but she gives a pretty exact approximation of how long she's been working there after a short pause. Well, 2 years, 7 months, 3 days, and 2 hours? Harry, who has pulled out a chair for Sarah and who is sitting directly in front of her, continues, great. So now, how long have you been in love with Carl, our enigmatic chief designer? Sarah coughs. 2 years, 7 months, 3 days, and an hour and a half? She gets a panicked look in her eyes. Do you think everyone knows? Harry says flatly, yes. Sarah swallows. Do you think Carl knows? Harry responds, yes. And now I think it might be time to do something about it. Take him out for a drink. Tell him you want to marry him and have his babies. Sarah is appalled. You know that? Harry responds, yes, and so does Carl. And any modern-day HR director would be showing this as an example of what not to do. However, sometimes your bosses are your friends, so I can kind of get it. But I also wonder, what the fuck is going on with Carl? Why hasn't he initiated anything? This is never fucking addressed here, Carl.
I know. So back to Carl, why he hasn't initiated anything, fucker.
I'm like, why, Carl? Get your act together.
Maybe he's very shy. But sure. I can't imagine because he's pretty fucking hot.
Oh my God, when he takes off his I'm like, whoa! I feel the feelings. His body is like, bah, 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 bah.
Corinne is practically biting her fist.
Yes. I was definitely feeling feelings.
But enough about Carl, because we are back into more romantic simulated sex. Ooh. In the section where Billy Mack, the aging musician, tells the truth. Hashtag sex doubles. John and Judy are back on the movie set. John and Judy bond over bad traffic until someone asks Judy to take off her top as they need to see what nipples are going to show in the scene. She removes it happily and leans topless against a column in the ornate room, her butt and a pair of jeans sticking out as John, who is fully clothed, pretends to hump her from behind. Then they ask John to cup and massage her breasts, and Corinne is like, y'all are definitely not going to see her nipples if his hands are covering them. But does John massage them titties? You'll have to stay tuned with us to find out after the break. And we're back. John nicely obliges after checking with Judy to make sure it's okay. He warms his hands and cups and massages her breasts, lightly humping her from behind and talking to Judy softly about traffic. It's simultaneously one of the sweetest and most explicit scenes in the movie so far. And now it makes sense because I'm like, why do they need to get the lighting on her nipples so perfect and not on his junk? Because I totally thought it was a porn. Yeah. Corinne's like, oh no, they wouldn't have this kind of production value on a porn. I'm like, yeah. Okay, that's why they don't need to fucking ring light his schlong. Now it makes sense.
But I will say, okay, so John and Judy, their growing relationship while they're simulating sex with each other throughout this movie is kind of very sweet. And let's just think about what if instead of John in this position, it was Colin, the pervy sandwich guy.
I'm going to stop you right there. Stop you right there. I think I would spend probably the first day with him and then be out sick for the rest of the year.
But I mean, like, and part of why this is so sweet is that John is like, hey, he checks with her. Even though he's been given this direction by the director, he checks with her. Is it okay if I cup your boobies? And she says yes. And then he warms up his fucking hands, which is just like so sweet. And, you know, he continues with having like just like kind of banal conversation with her. But like you think about him doing this, and then if you think about if Colin had this position instead, it would be a whole other story.
I don't think he would be let on to this. I think that he would be banned like after a minute. He'd be too much of a liability.
They're like, oh, God. We're banning you from the set and from London. Thank you.
Yes, that's right. What are you still doing in town? You need to get out of the city. I thought we told you. Anywho, across town at Radio Watford, a DJ plays Billy Mac's Christmas Is All Around Us. The DJ initially completely talks shit about the song until it's brought to his attention that Billy Mac is at the station and getting interviewed by the next show. Yikes. Yeah. Mike interviews Billy and kind of enjoys Billy's not giving a single fuck in the moment. He talks candidly about how the song is terrible, particularly where they try to squeeze an extra syllable into the fourth line. Mike knows exactly what he's talking about. I think you're referring to If You Really Love Christmas. Come on and let it snow. Billy nods. Yep, that's the line. He also candidly talks about his life, how it's rather sad now. He doesn't have any family or loved ones around, just his manager. And how he's hoping, in spite of the quality of the song, for some reason it'll become a runaway hit, and an old ex-heroin addict pop star can experience the feeling of having one more moment of glory. And me and Corinne talked at great length about Bill Nighy does not look good in this role. Like, he looks better now.
Yes.
20 years later.
Yeah.
Because the aging pop star persona does not suit him as well as him in real life, where it's just like a suit and dark rimmed glasses.
Later, he refers to himself as being in his 50s. And I was like, oh, he's joking about that. He's lying about his age. And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, no, never mind. He's
not. He is in his 50s. Is it a British thing? Because, you know, if he was supposed to be a heroin addicted pop star or into the drug ass, like, look at Mick Jagger, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Like, in the 80s, Mick Jagger was 50. And I was like, holy shit, no, he's not. Oh, yes, he is. How that man is still alive is beyond me. He's pretty much pickled himself, I'm sure.
A lot of the old rock stars are impressively preserved somehow. I'm not exactly sure how.
Yeah. They don't necessarily look good, but they are surviving.
Yes. In the 80s, Mick Jagger was in his 40s, but yes.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah. It's 4 weeks till Christmas, and David is having a meeting with a lot of British leaders and advisors or something like that. Because I'm an American, I don't really understand the nuances of the political cabinets here going on here. However, the president of the United States is coming for a lot of... Oh, Tam, do you want to explain to me the nuances of the European... the UK's political system that's going on in that
absolutely,
meeting?
Absolutely, Corinne. Well, see, there's some people that run shit.
Oh!
And there's some other people that run shit.
Oh!
And then they must come together to run shit.
Together?
That they all agree on, or somewhat agree on. You know, it doesn't have to be 100%, but most of them have to agree on the shit that they want to run, and then they do it.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for taking us on this journey. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated you laying it all out like that. It was simple, straight to the point.
Yes.
Blew my mind.
And one of the people that's running shit is the Prime Minister.
That added extra layer of nuance was like whipped cream on the sundae of your explanation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I didn't want to get too technical. They pronounce it Prime Minister.
Okay. Oh. Otherwise, I would have gotten confused. So I super appreciate you not getting too technical. So thank you. So according to Tam, the Prime Minister is in a room of people who help to run shit. And he also helps to run shit, and together they kind of make shit happen sometimes. Am I getting that right? Great. Thank you. So the people who help to run shit say that David should take a stand against the president of the United States. But David decides it's not prudent. Better to be clever and not piss off the United States. After he's made this declaration, he asks loudly, who do you have to screw around here to get a chocolate biscuit and a cuppa? And almost as if she'd been summoned, Natalie comes backing into the room with a cart of tea and, I'm sure, some chocolate biscuits. David is filled with fuck my life because he did not mean to have that comment directly linked to someone so gosh darn cute. Later, Natalie delivers him some paperwork and a tray with some tea and chocolate biscuits, admitting to him, I'm glad you got elected. Don't get me wrong, I would have been nice to the other guy. Just would have given him plain biscuits. She smiles and leaves the room as he thanks her, awkwardly taking her name onto the thanks after a pause. Once she leaves, he thunks his head on his desk, sternly telling himself to get a grip. Back with the sex doubles, Judy and John are once again body doubling in the expensive looking room. This time, both of them are naked and on the bed. Judy and John chat about the Prime Minister while Judy simulates riding him cowgirl style. John mentions as Judy shifts positions how lovely it is to work with someone he can talk to, and Judy is quite pleased by this.
Oh man, imagine simulating all that sex in silence. Wow. It's not awkward at all.
No. I would much rather be like, yes, the traffic on the 405 is awful.
Yeah. Everybody knows that. That's not exactly a stimulating conversation.
I'm sorry. I'll be talking about the Barbie movie, honestly, as I like simulate riding cowgirl on top of the guy. Have you seen the Barbie movie? Well, let me tell you.
So, we're going to be here for a while. I can go through the whole thing.
Exactly.
Start to finish.
Don't worry. I brought finger puppets.
And now we're back with Harry in his office in London, where he, Mia, the American Sarah, and the lusted after Carl work. We see Harry meeting with Mia in his office, prepping her so she can plan the Christmas party. Usual Christmas party stuff other than Harry letting Mia know that she should advise the girls to avoid Kevin if they want their breasts unfondled. Ew. Excuse me? Whose responsibility is it to make sure Kevin isn't fondling breasts? Yes, Kevin, I'm talking to you. You want to get fired? You fondle, okay? Thanks, bye. Mia asks, so wives and girlfriends and such? Harry responds, yes, but no children. Oof, you haven't got some hot tot t-shirt wearing 6-foot-tall boyfriend, have you? Mia looks him intently in the eyes. No, I'm just going to be waiting around the mistletoe, hoping to get kissed. She turns on her heel and saucily exits, leaving a slightly drooling Harry behind.
Ugh.
Is there something going on there? ?
I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
Oh no.
Yeah, I know, right?
And a little later, Sarah is still at the office, staying late at work. It's just her and Carl left. She covertly applies some makeup. It looks like she has a framed photo of Carl on her desk. Does she?
I think it's her brother, actually. But the picture looks a lot like Carl. And then when you meet her brother, you can see that from certain angles, he looks like Carl.
Oh, that's just weird. Ooh. Anyways, Carl gets up to leave, shutting off some lights and saying goodbye to Sarah on his way out. She didn't ask him to drinks and can't even pretend to wait for the elevator with him because as soon as he passes by, her phone rings and once again she's talking to a mysterious person on the other end, which she was doing at the wedding as well when Harry encouraged her to go after Carl.
Ugh. Meanwhile, Karen is visiting Daniel at his house. Karen, mother of first Lobster. In the nativity play.
Daniel, played by Liam Neeson still.
Yes. Just in case you had forgotten. He has concerns about his 11-year-old stepson, Sam, who I was like, how is this boy possibly 11 years old? He's got to be an 8-year-old playing an 11-year-old. And then I found out, no, he's a 13-year-old playing an 11-year-old. But he...
Shut up.
He is a tiny... young boy. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, but who plays Sam? Because he is the cutest little boy. He's gone on to do some like tween and adult movies, but God, yeah. He's adorable.
Yeah. Thomas Sangster. is who plays Sam.
He's super cute. He's super cutie little 11, 13-year-old.
Yes. 11, 13-year-old. Exactly. Sam won't leave his room. Karen tells him that he should be relieved about this, but she also says it doesn't matter what happens. This year is going to be a shit year. And, you know, pretty much truth, right? Like, the year after your mom dies, going to be a shit year. The year after your sister dies, pretty much going to be a shit year, you know?
Yeah.
Daniel starts to cry, and Karen kind of pats him on the back, but she doesn't really seem to be the nurturing type. She says, get a grip. People hate sissies. No one is going to shag you if you cry all the time.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, Emma Thompson, only you could deliver a line like that so beautifully.
Oh, my lands.
And I'm totally getting hope floats. You were just devastated and betrayed by your husband. Here's another hunk for you. Come on over and get it vibes from this moment. Yes. But...
what? You don't want it? You don't want more love? You don't want more love right after heartbreak? What's wrong with you?
You've only had your wife die. I mean, you just put her in the ground a week ago. It's fine. Emma Thompson somehow manages to make it feel a little funny because she's a genius. Daniel looks over at Karen and says dryly, yeah, you're right. Helpful. With a slight raise of his eyebrows. But if he were British, he might as well tell her to sod off.
Mm. So surprised that Daniel wasn't at the funeral and just, you know, heaved the coffin off of his shoulder and put his wife on that lift that gently lays her into the hole in the ground. And somebody behind him says, Daniel, this is my friend Anna. She's single. She's divorced, has a lovely 9-year-old girl. I think you guys would really get along.
She brought a rose to put on Joanna's casket, so don't you worry about it. Yes. She's got a heart of gold.
Uh-huh.
Oh, by the way, I brought this engagement ring. Wait, oh, actually, no, I say it. I took the ring from your wife's finger just, you know.
Oh, God, no. That's not tacky. No,
just
being frugal.
Just so that it will be ready for you when you're ready for my friend.
Right. Yeah. Recycle.
Recycle. Right? Reuse. Close that loop. We all know she's not going to use it in the ground. So, you know.
You don't know that. Later, Daniel, still played by Liam Neeson, takes his stepson out to the lakeside for a chat. They sit staring at the water, and Daniel asks Sam what's going on. He finally confesses, I know you think I'm set about Mom, and I am, but the truth is, I'm in love.
Aww.
Daniel's so relieved. Aren't you a little young to be in love? Sam gives him a withering look. No. Daniel agrees. Fair. I'm just so relieved that that's all it is, that you're in love. Sam's not having it. Being in love is gut-wrenching agony. It's truly the worst. Daniel's about to argue that love is grand when he pauses, reflects, and agrees. Yeah, you're right. And they sit in companionable silence on the beach.
Aww.
Later, Daniel tries to help Sam out with his dilemma and says, we've got this, Sam. Remember, I was young once, too. I can help. Sam comes out with it. Her name's Joanna. She's the coolest girl in school. She doesn't know I exist, but even if she did, she'd hate me. And everyone at school loves her. Daniel rubs his hands together thoughtfully, takes a breath, and admits, yep, you're screwed. Super helpful. Super helpful. Oh, I just love, like, the blatant remarks that everybody gives to each other in this movie. Oh, you like Joanna, and she's awesome, and doesn't know you exist? Oh, yeah, you're screwed. Oh. Don't be a sissy. Women will never shag you if you keep crying. Like, fucking ass, man. I mean, do people in England really talk like this? Like, are they really that blunt? Please write us in and let us know. OneDrakeKiss@gmail.com.
Oh, my gosh. I'm like, it's very exciting. But I do particularly love the relationship between Sam and Daniel, played by Liam Neeson. And just in case you were wondering, it is a little weird that Sam's crush has the same name as his recently deceased mother, but you know, I guess it's cute.
Yeah.
Question mark?
Yeah. And we also kind of, they don't say it overtly, but Sam was Joanna's son, not Daniel's. Daniel's a stepfather, but
yeah,
is left to raise Sam once Joanna passed away.
Yes. So.
that's why it's not like calling him dad and kind of not knowing where to tread with his troubles, because he doesn't want to, you know,
overstep
over the boundaries, yeah. but wants to be there for the little guy, the little 13-year-old playing an 11-year-old
yes.
that looks like an 8-year-old.
Yes. So as we get back to Mr. Darcy, I mean, Colin Firth, I mean, Jamie, we are fortunately saved from a brotherly mom's birthday dinner, because that would have been awkward. Also, I just got, I didn't write this in, but I should have. When Colin Firth kindly suggests they take their mom out for a birthday meal together, his brother's like, yeah, sounds kind of boring, but sure. And I'm like, asshole, I'm sorry. Are you doing anything for mama? I don't think so, asshole. He's doing something for his papa dick.
I was going to say, can't you just say that his brother is like an upstanding citizen and like an all-around good guy? You didn't get that from the short time we spent with him? He's a peach.
Yeah. Nothing says peach like your sibling sticking it to your significant other. Yay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh.
I wouldn't fucking go anywhere with my brother for a good 7 to forever years.
Yeah. I'm like, the girlfriend I can just break up with. The sibling who did that to me, I would have a very hard time reconciling that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But Jamie has decided to escape. He is no longer in the UK. He's in his French villa, as one is wont to do. You know, when one gets cheated on, just go off to one's French villa.
That's what I always do. Heartbreak, French villa. Or Italian countryside, whichever.
Yeah. Stub a toe, French villa, or mm-hmm. Italian countryside. Can't figure out what to have for breakfast, French villa, or countryside. Just got to run off. It's these hard life things that push me towards, you know, going to the villas in the countryside.
Where were they at in Unthinkably Good Things?
Oh, they were in the Italian countryside. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. See, that's why yeah. I just bounce back and forth.
Yeah. It's perfect.
Yep.
So Jamie goes to his French villa, as one is wont to do when one needs to get away. He has big plans to write. And what better way to write than a beautiful vintage typewriter? Go, go, inspiration! And I'm wondering, is he like an author or something like that? Not because writing your books on a vintage typewriter is a good idea, but just because he has the flexibility to get away to a French villa to, you know, type the day away, asking for a friend.
Yeah, seriously.
A few days later, he's greeted by Eleanor. What? Who is Eleanor? Do you know who Eleanor is? You've watched this movie so many times. I'm expecting you to explain some things to me. No.
They never specify.
Okay. I said, groundskeeper? Question mark? She's found someone to clean his house. I'm guessing that she looks after the property while he's away.
Yeah.
He gamely tries introducing himself in French, but the woman isn't responding. I would say because his French is so bad, but Eleanor explains that Aurelia is Portuguese. Jamie then bumbles badly through several languages, none of them Portuguese, while she looks at him blankly. Eleanor asks if he will give Aurelia a ride home after she's done with the cleaning, and he gamely agrees. However, on the ride to Aurelia's, he's like Birdie in Hope Floats, while she's on a boat, and he keeps on trying to make small talk in a multitude of languages, at one point drawing out a secret smile from Aurelia. Aurelia was not like Harry Connick Jr. in Hope Floats, because she did not tell him to shush. Oh, Jamie is thoroughly embarrassed, and I bet he wished he had Harry Connick Jr. in the car as well, telling him to shh, chill out, man.
No, I bet he didn't. I bet he didn't want that. Nobody wants that.
Just Nobody be cool. Wants that. Just be cool.
Okay. It's like somebody telling somebody to calm down when they are in their feels. It's not helpful.
Cameron, I'm just going to need you to breathe. It's fine.
You know what? I will breathe a little of that. How about that?
Oh, you like Anyways. Me. You really like me.
Back in the Prime Minister's office. Or back in doodly-doo-loo, Prime Minister land. David flirts with Natalie under the guise of not being an elitist prick and getting to know her better. She affably tells him that she lives in the dodgy area of Wandsworth on Harris Street. David says his sister lives in the non-dodgy area of it. Twinsies! But more importantly, he finds out that Natalie is recently single and living with her parents. Her ex broke up with her because she was fat. And no bloke wants to be with a woman whose legs are as big as tree trunks. Winner! David jokingly offers to have him killed, as he is prime minister after all, but she laughs it off and returns to work. As soon as she leaves, once again, David is a hot mess. I can't stand how everybody keeps talking about this girl like she's a freaking blimp. She is gorgeous and has a very nice figure.
She does. And the fat shaming in this movie throughout it is like one of, actually turns out to be one of my biggest beefs with this movie, because Aurelia, who is like a toothpick, says at one point, "I don't eat butter. If you saw my sister, you would understand." And I mean, it's just like sprinkled throughout this movie is all of this like super fat shamey stuff. And I'm like, no wonder we all have complexes. Jesus fucking Christ. Like, the only one I will forgive is Emma Thompson at one point, and I think that was just because she was insecure because her husband was being a dick. The remarks fly fast and furiously throughout this, and every time I'm like, and you're going to say what? Oh, okay.
Right. And back to hashtag Bill the aging rock star story. Billy Mac. Billy Mac's manager actually gets him on the Top of the Pops type show to plug his new album, and the two young male hosts welcome him on, saying, "Right now, your biggest competition for Christmas is all around is the boy band Blue." And for those who aren't British, Blue is an actual British boy band.
Which I didn't know.
I didn't know either. Billy continues his media circus of honesty. "Oh, yeah. I saw them on the show last week. They weren't very nice about my song, but they're talented musicians." The hosts quickly try and switch the topic. "Well, you said you have a prize for our competition winners." Billy casually gropes around in his pocket. "Why, yes, I do. It's this personalized felt tip pen." The hosts look appalled, but they have no idea what's in store. Billy holds up the pen QVC style and says, "The great thing about this pen is it can write on any surface, even glass. Here, let me demonstrate." And he turns to the large frame poster of Blue behind him, putting one large speech bubble above the four hunky men's heads and writing, "We've got tiny pricks" on it. Billy's manager watches on a monitor in dismay, and the host remind Billy, "There's a lot of kids watching." Billy barrels forward. "Oh, yeah. Hi, kids," he says, looking into the camera. "Don't buy drugs." The hosts nervously smile at each other, relieved that things are back on track, before Billy finishes his sentiment with, "Become a rock star and they'll give them to you for free."
Yay.
And if this shit were to happen today, there'd be so many memes of Billy's behavior going around, and it would be brilliant.
Oh, my gosh. I'd be sending them to you. You'd be sending them to me. It'd be the answer to everything. But what's not the answer to everything is hashtag gross bestie, a.k.a. Mark, who works at a gallery that currently has seasonal photography up. Very large pictures of naked people with strategically placed Santa caps. So artistic. He's on the phone at work with bestie Peter when Peter asks Mark if he can patch Juliet through. Peter says, "She's got something to ask you, and be nice." Mark, who always seems low-key irritated, agrees, and Juliet effusively gets on the line. "Hi, Mark. I saw you videotaping during our wedding and was really hoping to look at some of the footage because we got our wedding video back and it is fucked, wobbly, and out of color." Mark sighs. "I don't know if I have anything, but I'll take a look." Juliet happily responds, "Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it." And they get off the phone with each other. The next day, Mark is eating breakfast in his loft apartment, watching Billy Mac sing his Christmas song on a morning show, when there's a buzz at his door. It's Juliet. And she just invites herself into his apartment. I'm like, what the fuck? Excuse me? Like, is this your apartment, Juliet? I don't think so.
Well, in fairness, she did offer him pie as a bribe.
Yeah. What is it?
Pie for entry.
what was the pie? Something or another pie that she just wanted to eat, but not them. And I have a feeling is some kind of strange British pie that most people don't like. I don't know. Anyways, she's hoping to see his video footage. Weeky, weeky. No, that's not a euphemism. And also convince Mark that she's an okay human being. Even though he says he's got to go and he'll find the videotape later, she cruises through all of his shelves and finds the videotape and pops it into the VCR. So, yeah, that's not cute at all. How she, like, behaves in his apartment and, like, proximity to him, I am like, who the fuck are you? Jesus Christ, you entitled woman. I know. She is Juliet, and she's used to getting her way because she's pretty and she smiles. So she pops the video into the VCR. And at first, she's super happy about the video until she realizes that it's only video of her. This isn't awkward at all. And I suspect if Mark had a drone, he'd be regularly flying it over Juliet and Peter's house to get video of her in there. But this is before the age of video drones. And once she realizes what is going on, Mark quickly leaves saying, take what you want, but don't show the video to a bunch of people as it needs some editing, like to look less creepy. Yes, it does. He leaves Juliet in his apartment, probably so she can find the shrine he made to her in his closet, and runs off to be anywhere but near her.
Ew.
That video was so fucking creepy. And he had, like, he had edited it. So it was like, does he just sit there and wink to the video, like, to the wedding video? I don't know.
Yeah. Like, Peter is not in any of the frames. It's just super close-ups of Juliet, her face, like,
yeah,
at the wedding, at the reception, dancing, at the boat, like, leaving the reception. It's intense.
Yeah, you could maybe make a 10-second video that would be a very, very summarized wedding video that had tiny glimpses of Peter in it, but, like, that would be about the amount that you could get out of it without it being super creepy.
Nope, it's creepy.
Yeah.
It is all the kinds of creepy. And now we're back in London in the office of Harry, where he encourages Karen to go after Carl, but she insists that he's too good for her and her cell phone. Dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee rings, interrupting their conversation, and she leaves to take the call. Harry moves over to his assistant, Mia. He stands at her desk and she updates him at her seat, saying that she's got a space for their Christmas party, a gallery full of dark corners to do dark deeds. Is she going to off her boss like murder? No, she wants to get off with her boss, like in a winky winky way.
Ew.
And a winky winky would have been more subtle than what she does, which is to turn towards him in her office chair and spread her legs wide open, not showing her panties because her short skirt is a bit too long for that. But the message is clear. She wants to bone down her boss man.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to that Aged Well with Paul and Erica when they did Love Actually.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, I'm pretty sure it was Erica, was just like, what the fuck is this storyline? Like, how can that girl be so into that? So how could Mia be so into Alan Rickman? Because she is gorgeous and young, and Harry's Alan Rickman, who's, like, you know, fine in his own regard, but just kind of like, they were making it out like Mia was leaps and bounds out of his league. And I'm like, I feel like it could totally be like a cash grab, like a status smash. So when they were saying that, I'm just like, I totally get it. Like, I don't get it. I don't think it's right. But right. I can totally see, like, some young, attractive girl going, oh, you have money and you're well off. Well, I want some of that. So I like you. I'm going to spread my legs in front of you in my office chair.
I think that you are right. I think that that is... because they don't show her connecting with him in a different way. But I will say that the way that he connects with Laura Linney, who plays Sarah, I found it to be, like, kind of hot. And I could see myself being in Mia's position and being attracted to him. If I were, I would play it differently. Also, I would have, like, a different kind of connection with him than she does. Because she's just like...
let's fuck.
Yeah, she's just like, let's fuck, and she doesn't, and they're not like, oh yeah, what about this? Oh yeah, what about that? Like, they're not connecting on anything.
No. And she just got there. Like, she hasn't been there very long. So it's like, hi, you, I want you, I want some of that. Like, whatever this is, I want that. Like, without knowing a lot about him. I mean, she probably knows that he has a family at home. And she's just, like, bulldozing it aside. Like, fuck that shit. You, me, bone, now.
Yeah. She is throwing out a whole lot of sexual energy. And it is so uncomfortable. I am like, huh.
I'm a little turned on myself. Just kidding.
You're like, oh, Mia. Wow. No, no.
Meow, Mia, meow. And now we're flying back to David's office, the prime minister. Back in prime minister land, the American president has arrived. Woo! And he is played by Billy Bob Thornton. He is a womanizing asshole and has left his wife behind in the States. He claims because he doesn't want her to be bored, but I suspect it's so he can fuck around. As David, the prime minister, and the president walk and talk, Natalie passes by. The president makes sure to greet her and makes extra sure to get a long look at her retreating figure before remarking about how she's got great pipes. Ugh. Corinne writes, I'm not sure what that's a euphemism for. I always thought it was boobs, but he saw her backside. And so I'm like, maybe it's legs?
I mean, pipes would make it seemed like legs, but it would just, it's an odd expression.
Yeah, it like brings me back to Clueless when what's his name tells Cher that she's got nice stems when he looks at her legs.
Yeah.
So maybe pipes are, American president version of it. More hearty, more American. Pipes are way more American. What I do know is that during the PM and his cabinet's meeting with the president refuses to negotiate on anything. After the meeting, David and the prez are hanging out in more of a living room type place, and the prez, who's lounging on the couch, says, I'm sorry for being so hardline in that meeting. I just have these objectives that I'm determined to make in my 4 years. You understand, right? David responds, sure, but there is one matter that's close to me that I want to talk to you about. The prez responds, I'll agree to anything you want, unless it's something I don't want. You're so funny. David leaves the room to grab a folder, and Natalie passes by bringing drinks into the room where the president is. By the time David comes back, he sees the prez standing very close to a very uncomfortable Natalie, whispering in her ear, ew. Natalie quickly scurries away, but before she leaves, the prez calls after her, hey, Natalie, I hope I get to see more of you as our great nations work towards a brighter future.
Ew.
Natalie politely responds, thank you, sir, and leaves. And the prez looks at David stonily like, what, bitch? I do what I want. While David gets a look on his face of, okay, I see you. And it is on.
And we cut to the press conference where David, the PM, and the prez are both standing at their own podiums. The president states, my visit has been great and we got to do what we came for and our special relationship is still very special. Saying a whole lot of nothing, which is a very American politician thing to do. David in turn responds, we do have a relationship, but currently that relationship is one of the president taking what he wants and ignoring what matters to, he stares at Natalie and then refocuses saying, Britain. David then goes on to state that Britain is a great nation, including such people as Churchill, Shakespeare, the Beatles, and David Beckham's left and right foot. And a friend who bullies us is no longer a friend. And since bullies only respond to strength, from now on, I will be prepared to be much stronger. And the press should be prepared for that. The president looks over stonily, pissed. And David drops his mic and calls on another reporter as the room bursts into chatter. After his triumphant press conference, David receives a call from his sister Karen, Emma Thompson, who opens with, have you gone completely insane? But David pish-poshes her and quickly gets off the phone. Karen, who is in her living room, turns to her husband, Harry.
You mean Harry from the office that was getting hit on by Mia?
Yes, that Harry from the office, from the London office, who is getting hit on by Mia.
That same Harry that was giving Sarah all the advice about going after that guy?
Yes, the very same Harry that was giving whatever her name is, that advice about going after Carl. Yes, that Harry.
It all intertwines. It's all connected. That means Harry is also father to the first lobster girl.
Yes.
That bastard.
And it also means that he has been eye flirting with Mia. Because even though he hasn't been saying anything, he's been holding some gazes. Karen, friend and advisor of Daniel Liam Neeson, mother of Lobster Girl, and wife to Harry, who works in London. She says, seriously, what did my brother do today? Oh, just stood up to the country. And what did I do today? Made a papier-mâché lobster head. Harry doesn't address anything, instead asking with disdain, what is this music? Karen responds, Joni Mitchell. I have a true love for her and her music. She's the person who taught me how to feel and that true love never dies. Harry rolls his eyes. Remind me to send her a letter thanking her. And it's like, wow. I know. His wife is expressing frustration over how important she feels in relationship to her world and community. And he just totally blows her off. And I'm like, Harry, you motherfucker.
Yeah.
Can you be more of an asshole? Well, I think we're going to find that out real soon.
So, back at Prime Minister Land, David, after giving his epic speech, is alone, or where he thinks he's alone, in his office, when he hears a radio off in the distance praising his brave words against the president. And the radio DJ says, this next song is going out to our prime minister. And it is Jump by the Pointer Sisters. And David proceeds to dance like nobody is watching around his office. He is shimmying. He is shaking his fanny. He is traipsing up and down the stairs and having the time of his life until it gets to the part of the song that says, I'll take you down. I'll take you down. And he's lip syncing along and he is pointing at all the walls. I will take you down and you down and you down and you down until he turns and sees his assistant and just plays it off like, oh, so I think we're going to move the 2 o'clock appointment to later on in the afternoon, please. She says, anything you want, sir, and leaves with a smirk on her face because he was dancing like nobody was watching and somebody very well was.
I mean, but who can't dance to Jump? Please.
Yeah, it's contagious.
It's contagious.
Try not dancing to Jump. Yeah. And hashtag Mr. Darcy, I mean, Colin Firth, I mean, Jamie. We are now returning to the Emerald Country fields of Pride and Prejudice, where Mr. Darcy, oh wait, we're in Love Actually, where Jamie's typing away at his French villa, having conversations with Aurelia, where they are so in sync with each other that Jamie's speaking in English and Aurelia Portuguese. But they're both referring to the same thing over and over again. They've gotten into a familiar rhythm with each other where Aurelia cleans his copious coffee cups and brings him more coffee and Jamie tippy-typies away. One day he's outside typing in front of a sad-looking pond, the pages of his novel being held in place with coffee cups. Aurelia, not realizing this, lifts a mug to rinse, wash, and repeat and exchange it with a fresh cup of coffee. But unfortunately, a huge wind whips up and blows all of his papers into the sad-looking pond.
Ooh, that is the grossest-looking pond, too.
It is. She's appalled and runs to the end of the dock, stripping off her dress, and the camera does a very nice pan of her body. Thanks. Where we get to see she has what we in the early 2000s called a tramp stamp, a.k.a. a lower back tattoo. Jamie tries stopping her, but she dives in, and he feels compelled to dive after her. They both muck about in the pond while she usefully grabs pages of the manuscript and he uselessly tells her, don't worry about it, it's crap, while he freaks out about the potential of eels being in the water. They ultimately go back to his French cottage and he gets her a blanket and a hot beverage while her clothes dry. Through pantomime, she finds out that he's writing a murder/crime book and then she quasi-asks gestures that if after he gets dressed, he'll give her a ride home. He nods, oh yes, of course. They look into each other's eyes and he says to her, it's my favorite part of the day, spending that time with you. And she says to him in Portuguese, it's the saddest part of my day, leaving you. When he drives her home that day, they keep on stealing glances at each other, knowing that they don't need to speak each other's language because they speak the language of love. Ooh. But really, I think they ought to try speaking each other's language and potentially getting to know each other for real versus the fiction they have of each other in their heads. I'm just saying is all.
I think that that scene is so cute. When they're talking to each other in their respective languages.
Yes, it's super cute. Because he's like, I have this constitution where I can eat anything and not gain any weight in English. And she looks at him and says, you better stop eating those croissants. I can see you getting fatter and fatter every day.
And thus the fat shaming. Yes.
Fat shaming.
That's also when she talks about how she doesn't eat them because... Because he offers her one and she doesn't eat them because mm-hmm. of her sister. If you saw my sister, you'd understand. And I'm like, honey, a bite of croissant is not going to turn you into some kind of boom boom monster. Like, ugh. However, back in the prime minister land, David goes from being the hero of the day in one deft stroke to being the ODK villain of the moment. Fear not, gentle listeners. He gets replaced with other people later.
Because they keep coming. The villains keep a-coming.
And they're a lot worse than this. David asks Annie to move Natalie out of the position where she'd be helping him. Because Lord knows, men and their urges, right? They simply can't control themselves.
No.
No.
That's why women gotta cover up and not dress scantily because guys can't help themselves.
She needs to bind those breasticles down because she's just, you know, she's just mm-hmm. too curvy and they just can't resist. Ugh. She was a series regular on EastEnders, Natalie, but she ended up getting punted even though she was a very popular series regular because she Shannon Doherty'd it. She was just like getting very demanding and being like, I can be here these days, but I won't be here these days. And, you know, and so, yeah, the actress, not actually Natalie, the prime minister assistant. Uh-huh. That wasn't where she was punted off to. She wasn't punted off to work at EastEnders. But anywho, also, Annie makes derogatory remarks about Natalie's figure. Yay! Which is simply ridiculous. Natalie has a banging bod, I say, and she does. Also, Annie happily moves Natalie to another position. David is spared the indignity of having to see her again. Oh, phew. Woo.
Yes, good thing.
Did you see how inappropriately she was with the president? I mean, she was just practically lusting all over him.
She was Mia-ing him up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that sexual energy was just radiant, palpable. Yes, it was palpable. Ugh. But we move on from the prime minister to Daniel, a.k.a. Liam Neeson, just in case you forgot. He gets the news from his son that Joanna, his crush, is moving back to America. No! Daniel says, well, it's obvious what we need in this situation. Kate and Leo. And at first I thought he was talking about the terrible time-traveling romance vehicle for Meg Ryan and Hugh Jackman called Kate and Leopold, but no. What he was referring to was Titanic, and I still question this decision, although he was wise enough to turn it off during the high point where they stand at the bow of the ship and before the naked portrait car sex and ultimate drowning of Leonardo DiCaprio because Kate Winslet refused to share a floating door with him.
I mean, the kid's lost his mother. He probably can handle a lot worse than that.
Sam is impressed, though, with the whole romance of the abbreviated, expurgated version of Titanic.
Mm-hmm. And that Titanic must have given him inspiration. Ooh. Because he is struck when he stops in front of a storefront to watch Billy Mack singing his Christmas songs with a bunch of sexy ladies dressed in red, pretending to play instruments behind him in a very Robert Palmer style. And if you don't know who that is, check out his videos in the 80s. And it was almost identical. When he comes home, he enthusiastically announces to Daniel that he has a plan. Daniel's very supportive, asking, "Great, finally, what's your plan?" And Sam explains, "Women love musicians, and Joanna's going to be in the Christmas pageant, and I can make her fall in love with me by doing a fantastic music performance." Daniel's all in except for one little insignificant issue. And Sam knows exactly what that is. "I know I don't play an instrument, but I will." Cut to Sam clunking away on drums in his bedroom. Oof, I was hoping he was going to air guitar.
And I have to say, I love how Daniel supports Sam. He's just like, "You have an idea? It's a bad idea? All right, let's do it." You know, he just
better than not doing anything.
Exactly. He just blindly supports him and is enthusiastic about it. And I love that. Oh, it's so sweet. Mr. Darcy, a.k.a. Jamie, finally packs his car full of Parisian goods to give to people for Christmas, gives Aurelia a final ride home, and when he drops her off, she boldly gives him a kiss. He's into it, but doesn't really say anything and drives off, completely muddle-headed, and crashes into another car when he's pulling away from the curb.
You know, I think that is the perfect place to end with a car crash.
Well, so now I pose this question to you, Tamara.
Sure.
Will Mia get that kiss under the mistletoe? Sam drum his way into Joanna's heart? David figure out that there are better ways to woo Natalie than getting her moved somewhere else? Daniel sweep Claudia Schiffer off her feet? Jamie speak to Aurelia in a language she can literally understand? Emma gets swept off her feet by Harry, who decides to reignite the spark in their relationship? Gross Bestie, a.k.a. Mark, create a gallery exhibit devoted to Juliet? Billy Mack streak through London wearing only a Santa hat, singing his Christmas song? Sarah do a sexy Christmas striptease for Carl to let him know her feelings? Judy and John get naked with each other outside of a movie set? And will Colin the Sandwich Perv make his way to America to sexually harass women across the globe? Keep those listening ears listening next week to find out.
The answer is no, yes, 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 no, yes, 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 and yes.
Wow, way to keep track of things. I like that.
To be continued.
To be continued.
Oh my goodness. I am so excited for round two of this, although we can't do it tonight because I have to go to bed at some point, Tam. I'm sorry. We just can't.
Oh, we've only been at it for 2 hours, wussy. But gentle listeners, we really appreciate you bearing with us as we go through. And you can see why we broke it into two sections. You can see it's a fucking mammoth of a movie. So many moving parts. So many.
Well, I have a question for you, Tam. What are we watching next week? Or what are we going over next week?
Well, we're going to do the Hallmark classic movie. I'm just kidding. We're doing Love Actually, the second part.
Love Actually-er, I believe.
Love Actually-est.
Yeah.
Love Actually 2, Electric Boogaloo.
And if you have anything that you'd like to let us know about Love Actually or anything else, Christmas in August, etc., you can reach out to us via email at onedrykiss@gmail.com or through the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Although Twitter, I'm suspecting, is going to go the way of the dino now that it's X instead of Twitter. Oof. Yeah.
So what do you do if you don't tweet? Because it's not Twitter. You X explain. Ex-
Man explains.
Exasperbate. What the fuck are you supposed to say?
I don't know. I'm thinking about opening a Facebook chat room for our ODK fam. Yeah,
we can always just join thread. Apparently, that's a thing, too.
Yes. So you can reach out to us all at One Dry Kiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. O-N-E. And as always, if you could find the time to rate and review us anywhere you listen to your podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. But in the meantime, we appreciate you stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. See you next time.
See you next time.
To get all your answers. Break for titty massages. Break for titty massages. Break for titty massages. Hide those nipples.
Hide those nipples.